All right, welcome to a special Pelican Pages segment here at Dixie Broadcasting, and we're very pleased to have a very special guest with us in the studio tonight. But before that, let me just start by saying this is Ray McBerry, one of your hosts here for the program tonight, and I've got my other Late Night Live co-host with me tonight, Hillbilly Terry. Terry, how's it going tonight?
It's going wonderful, Brother Ray, and of course I'm excited about this Pelican segment we're going to be doing. We have, I think, what is one of the finest stars, authors in the Southern movement today, if not authors in general. So it's going to be fun, Brother Ray.
Well, I know at least one other gentleman from the same neck of the woods that might have something to say about whether he's the best author or not, but he's definitely right up there in the top two, I'd have to say.
Well, we didn't get to interview Faulkner, so we'll try this.
Folks, we are very pleased to have with us tonight on this Pelican Pages segment, Mr. Ron Kennedy. Ron is no stranger to most of our listeners in the Southern movement. He is a co-author with his brother of one of the best-selling books that is out. It's actually a hardback book that's a bestseller, The South Was Right. And many of us came into the Southern movement because of having read that book, The South Was Right. Ron is not only the co-author of The South Was Right, but also the book Was Jefferson Davis Right? And Ron has... Ron, what was the first book that you all came out with?
Well, thank you, Ray, and thank you, Terry, and all for having me on your program tonight. And hello, folks out there in web land. The first book that Don and I came out with was, of course, The South Was Right.
Okay.
And you know, I want to encourage everybody out there, stick with your dreams, because my twin brother and I are just two old country boys from Mississippi. You know, what do we know about publishing books? And yet we just had this passion for the South. We've always had it. And if we have time, I can tell you about growing up in Mississippi and what my grandfather and great-grandmother told us about our ancestors fighting in the war. And we were very upset because no one was telling our side of the story. So we decided we were going to write a book. Well, we never wrote a book before. What do you know about writing books, boys, you know? But we just sat down and wrote the first edition of South Was Right way back in 1987 when we first started on it, and self-published it. Some people call it vanity publishing. And it did so well, we were able to get Pelican Publishers out of Gretna, Louisiana, a regional publisher, to pick it up, and it has sold well over 100,000 copies in its second edition, and we're quite proud of that book.
And by the way, with that being a hardback book, 100,000 copies is quite a phenomenal number. That happens a lot more frequently with a paperback book than it does a hardback, isn't that right?
Oh, absolutely. Once you reach 100,000 in hardback, it's considered a bestseller. So we've got a bestseller on our hands, and we've got really about 120,000 now that has been sold. And it happens about maybe 5% of the books that are published would get to that kind of circulation. You know, it's not unusual if you got some neocon talking head on TV every night to write a book and get a lot of people to buy it, but for someone to come out of the South and with no base other than a passion for the South and to have that kind of success, it says a lot about the South. It reminds me of what was said about Virginia after the war when they put the statue of Robert E. Lee up. There's life in the Old Dominion yet, and it's true not only for Virginia, but it's true for the whole South, and really, as we see it, the whole country has a stake in this fight now.
Now, Ron, you're originally from Mississippi, and now you call Louisiana home, is that right?
Yeah, we always laugh and say, Don and I left Mississippi and came to Louisiana, and we improved the collective IQ of both states at the same time. But, yeah, we were born and raised in the Red Clay Hills of Mississippi. I love the state of Mississippi. It's my home. It's where my parents are buried. My ancestors are buried there. And one day, I hope that's a long time from now, but one day that's where my mortal remains will be. But I've been in Louisiana a little bit less than Don has. We've been here since the mid-1970s. He's up in North Louisiana, and I'm down here in South Louisiana, down close to the Hurricane Center.
Oh, fun. Now, Ron, we've got you on the program tonight. We'd like, if it's okay with you, to devote a good portion of the program tonight to talking about this new book that you have out with Pelican entitled Reclaiming Liberty, because I know that the contents of the book are something that you had wanted to get out for quite some time, if I understand the story correctly, and now it's in book form, and I know that you see it as a very key stepping stone, or the ingredients of it anyway, to what really is going to be essential for restoring liberty to Dixie, if nowhere else.
That's true. And remember, if you can't save the whole community, at least save your own house. So that's why we say that if America doesn't want the precious gift of liberty, well, Dixie does. So we'll take it. We'll save our own house if the rest of the community doesn't want to go along with it. But Donald and I, when we wrote The South Was Right, and it's interesting. That was about 20 years ago. We said that we want to write this book in order to encourage the people of the South to understand the rich value of their heritage and what it means for freedom. And we put in The South Was Right that this is a call for a radical restoration of the original Republic of Republics. And this was back in the late 80s. This was a radical statement. You didn't see too many people saying stuff like that. And we followed that book up with Why Not Freedom, which came along right at the time of the 1994, I believe it was, when the Republicans managed to have their contract for America. It was, November the 8th, I do believe, of 94. But everyone was very excited and thought, wow, this is great. At last, we've got conservatives in power, and now everything's going to be just right. Well, Donald and I, in our book, Why Not Freedom, said, no, wait, it won't be right. You can't control the federal government by electing more conservatives. You got to do more than that. And we put in Why Not Freedom, which was the next step from The South Was Right. Hey, this is how we lost our liberty. This is how we got away from freedom. We ignored our founding fathers' constitutional theory of government. And this is what we have. That's what we demonstrate in Why Not Freedom. But and in so doing, we said, look, in order to have real states' rights, you've got to have the right of secession. Well, that was near heresy. And people said, no, that's treason. So then we wrote, was Jefferson Davis right? Because that defends the right of secession. So in Was Jefferson Davis Right, we, again, following the train of thought that we started with The South Was Right. Now we're saying, no, you've got to have the right of secession in order to be truly free in our American system. If you don't have that, you don't have an American system. You have what amounts to a German, Prussian, central nation state. Then once we got that book through, the issue of slavery was dealt with by Dowling, his book, Myths of American Slavery, and then I went to work writing this latest book, Reclaiming Liberty. And this is the book that brings it all together and says, look, you take your heritage, you understand how we lost our freedom, you understand that secession is absolutely necessary, it's a prerequisite for the right to protect your liberty under our original Republic of Republics. You've got to have that. And this is how we reclaim our liberty. This is how we offer to America what we call a liberty-based society, a society that Thomas Jefferson, John C. Calhoun, Jefferson Davis would be very proud to live in. Nothing like what we have today.
You know, Ron, I find it very interesting that you made the comparison of what we have today in Washington to a German-Prussian central state model, especially considering the close ties between the Bush family for three generations and the things that went on over on the continent of Europe, especially in Nazi Germany, dating back to the early 1930s. And then, of course, they brought those same folks back over here and set them back up in shop again once the war was over, and they just set them up here in America.
It's amazing when you look back at our history, and we cover this in Reclaiming Liberty, that our system that we have today is really, you tell Americans this and they're shocked at first, But we don't have a free society anymore. We have a national socialist society, and it's patterned after the Bismarck pattern of Prussian Germany, and very similar to what the fascists and the Nazis set up as far as a centralized socialist state. We today in America live in a virtual socialist society, and that's why we're not free. And as long as we accept that status, as long as we accept the political system that has forced that upon us, we will never be free.
And Terry and I had a very well planned out system here, Ron, of how we were going to ask you questions tonight, and I have already totally messed that whole system up.
Well, the first question I had in my mind has already been thoroughly answered, I believe. So, but I did want to make a comment about the German Prussian model as opposed to the American model. And you know, I think it's also interesting if you go back, based upon what Professor McWinney said, talking about the Celtic background of the South, and then also in Connor's book, The South Under Siege, where he makes a certain delineations between what the Northern society as opposed to Southern society. Northern society is basically a Teutonic one, whereas ours is a Celtic one. And it doesn't surprise me that they, since they've been in control of things for the last 140 years, that we ended up with a Teutonic-style government.
Yeah, you know, it's very interesting because even you go back to Abraham Lincoln, he sustained a lot, or he received a lot of support from the failed socialist revolutions in Europe of the 1840s, late 1840s. And a lot of those socialists came over to America. You know, none of them that I know of, there may have been one or two, but the vast majority of them went over and worked with the Union side to defeat the South during the War for Southern Independence. And it's not surprising because Lincoln, Marx, all the socialists, they like big government. They like central power. You break power down and send it down to the people at the local level, and you can't socialize them very efficiently. They have a really effective means of preserving their private property rights. But if you take those powers and bring it into the central state and put one strong man in charge, whether it's Lincoln or whether it's Joseph Stalin or Adolf Hitler, you put one strong man in charge, and then you can socialize society very effectively, and you can prevent people from walking away, from seceding from your tyranny.
You know, Ron, as a thing, Al Benson Jr. has written extensively on this 48er slash communist infiltration of the Union in the 1830s, 40s, 50s, 1840s and 50s, particularly with after the failed revolutions in 48, and then a bunch of them moved over here, and of course we know the Union Army, I suppose you could probably tell me the figures, I've heard as high as a third of the Union Army were made up of Germans, but you have a whole bunch of ex-revolutionaries over here immediately after the failed revolution to the 48 and so on. And Missouri, of course, was a microcosm of what's been done to the entire country as far as these Germanic communists taking over everything and remaking the state into their little dream world.
And it's true, and matter of fact, Al and my twin brother have a book coming out that's going to, I forget the title, and my brother's going to be real upset that I forget the working title, but it's basically just what you're talking about, the infiltration of the socialist movement into the Union Army and the Union itself during the war, and how that had a great influence. I mean, you stop and look. During the war, Lincoln set up the IRS. We didn't have an IRS until Lincoln set up the IRS. Taxes increased tremendously. We never had those kind of taxes. They didn't have to. They were siphoning the money out of the South. You see the connection, not that Lincoln and Marx and the socialists were all, you know, in some conspiracy together, But, you know, birds of a feather tend to flock together. They all
That's right.
like big government. They like to have the control, and they don't want the people to be free. Now, our job today is to say, well, that was then. This is now. What are we going to do about it today? And that's what Reclaiming Liberty is about. How are we going to get from where we are back to where we want to be? How are we going to have a future that's better for you, for me, for our children, our grandchildren? If we don't do something, then we are going to go from where we are now, which is we are Uncle Sam's tax serf, to the point of being his, our grandchildren will be tax slaves. I mean, we will have no freedom left. Conservatively, we're probably around 40 to 50% socialized as it stands now. So it speaks very well of the free enterprise system that's left, how strong it is that it can maintain itself even under that much government intervention into the free market. But that won't last forever. And as the elections are coming up, as the socialists, I call them socialists because they are socialists. They can call themselves neoconservatives. They can call themselves conservatives. They can call themselves liberals, but they are, in fact, socialists. They want the government to control the distribution of wealth in America. And 40 to 50% of it's being done now. In another 4 years, if Hillary or whoever gets elected, or if we are blessed with another traditional Republican like Bush has been, who has raised the welfare state more than anyone since LBJ, I mean, good gracious, who could do more harm than the Republicans?
You touched on that neoconservative vein a little bit, and we were talking about, we've kind of established the roots of this thing. Let me just ask you what a natural progression here. A lot of people would look at what the body of work that you and your brother have done, and they may even classify what you've done as quote-unquote conservative. Tell us, Ron, what's the difference between you and your brother's works and other conservative books?
Yeah, well, thank you for making the distinction, because I don't really consider myself a conservative, because even you look back, you ask the average conservative, God love them, you know, most of them don't think beyond, the latest ramblings of Rush Limbaugh. But, you know, you ask them, what are you trying to conserve? And they sort of look at you sort of like a doe in the headlights, you know, what do you mean? Well, you say you're a conservative, what are you trying to conserve? Well, are you trying to conserve high taxes? Are you trying to conserve inflation? Are you trying to conserve fiat money, where the government prints all the money it wants whenever it wants to and effectively robs your purchasing power without any consent of Congress? I mean, what is it that you're trying to conserve? And they don't know. What Don and I are saying is the system that we currently have is fatally flawed. The system is flawed. You don't revive it. You don't repair it. You replace it. It's very simple as that. What model do you use? Well, you use what we call a liberty-based society. It's a system that our founding fathers would have been very at home with. Basically, it says that government cannot have any taxing authority beyond 10% of the GDP. That's it. That's state, local, and federal. I mean, if the Lord God Almighty can get by on 10%, so can Uncle Sam. So 10%. So you cut government funding off first, and then you come back and say, we, the people of the sovereign states, have the right to nullify any federal rule, edict, court order that infringes upon our reserve rights. If the balance of the states don't agree with us, then we have the right to secede, to peacefully secede. You know, if you and I were in a partnership and we disagreed with each other, we wouldn't see who was the strongest, and that strongest one would rule the partnership. We would peacefully separate ourselves and go our own way.
It's a limited constitutional government, Ron. You could characterize it by saying that it's not something that's been tried and failed. It's something that's not been tried.
I think it was tried and rejected. and it was rejected by the northern majority. It wasn't rejected by the south.
Your liberty-based society, which you cover heavily in your book, Reclaiming Liberty, is basically an argument for the original system of limited constitutional government.
Exactly. That's why I say, George Mason, Madison, Thomas Jefferson, Patrick Henry, they all would be very at home in this system. But the point that we're doing is we're saying, look, you can't repair something that's fatally flawed. The current system is fatally flawed. We go on to say in the very first chapter, conservative failure, it's over a century of failure of conservatives. And I put the blame of where we are not on the liberals. It's not LBJ's fault we are where we are. It's not even FDR's fault that we are where we are. I put the blame on the conservatives. They are the ones that have never come up with a rational alternative, a workable alternative to the system of income redistribution and government intrusion that the liberals put forward every year. And if you'll look at it and see, I'll give you an example. Social Security, FDR, back in 1933, let's have a system of Social Security. The conservatives went crazy in Congress. No, that's socialism. We can't have that. And they fought and did a whole bunch of just real shenanigans trying to prove to the world that they were against it. Well, they lost. In early 1950s, the conservatives got control of Congress for the first time since FDR. Did they try to undo Social Security? No, sir. What did they do? They added to it. They saw a new way to buy votes. So they just got in there and did just as good as the liberals did. The conservatives have never been an opposition party. They've always been someone that would collaborate with the liberals once the liberals advanced to point A. Then the conservatives would take over and defend the liberal position, yesterday's liberal position, and then the liberals were free to go forward to push the bounds of liberalism or socialism even further.
You know, another good analogy, an example of that is on social policy. Pastor Chuck Baldwin recently wrote an article, I think it was entitled The Party of Death, where, you know, the Democratic Party has sometimes been referred to as the party of death because of their platform statement on baby killing. And he demonstrates, even though that the Republican Party has controlled things for a longer period, or for the majority of the time, since Richard Nixon, that they've done little or nothing to change the situation with abortion in this country.
And you see there, what is the main objective of America's politicians, whether they be liberal or conservative, whether they be Republican or Democrat? What is their main objective? They've got two main objectives, and I point this out clearly in that very first chapter of Reclaiming Liberty. There are two objectives. Number one is incumbency. All right, got to get reelected. That means I got to get enough money from the people that need me to give them favors in order to get reelected. And the other thing is maintaining the status quo. We can't offer viable alternatives, a liberty-based society, for example, because that would ruin this neat little deal we've cut for ourselves. The politicians, they're, as we say in Mississippi, they're like fat hogs feeding at the low end of the trough. And they're not about to let us cut the slop off or get them out of the low end of the trough. And I don't care if they're liberal or conservative, if they're Republican or Democrat, their primary objective, maintain the status quo and maintain myself in office. Whether or not we, the people, are left with any of our private property to run our lives with, to raise our families, to be safe in our communities, that makes no difference whatsoever. It's a good populist point that they'll bring up for home consumption just around election time, but the rest of the time, forget it. Our job is like the sheep. We're supposed to go out and make more wool, and once or twice a year, around April 15th, they'll come and shear it off of us. And God help us the day they start getting a taste for mutton.
Well, folks, you're listening to a Pelican Pages segment here at Dixie Broadcasting tonight, and we're very privileged to have Mr. Ron Kennedy on the broadcast with us. Ron is the author of a new book out with Pelican Publishing entitled Reclaiming Liberty. And if you're interested in looking at Ron's book, Reclaiming Liberty, or The South Was Right, or any of the other books by the Kennedy brothers, you can find those online by going to epelican.com. And, of course, you can do a search there under the Browse category and just type in the name Kennedy and click Authors, and it'll pull up all of their works, and you can take a look at all of them, and you can even order them online directly from Pelican and save yourself money in the process of doing that. Pelican Publishing is one of our sponsors here at Dixie Broadcasting, and they're one of the reasons that you're able to listen to Dixie Broadcasting 24 hours a day, 365 and a quarter days of the year. And so we hope that you will go to the website there at Pelican and look and find something that you like and let them know that you appreciate them sponsoring Dixie Broadcasting. We're going to give Ron just a couple of minutes to take a break and get something to drink. And while we're doing that, Terry will probably rake me over the coals for getting out of line with our series of questions for tonight. So while Terry straightens me out, get something to drink and head on back over to the computer, and we'll finish this interview in just a few minutes. All right, welcome back to another Pelican Pages segment. This is Ray McBerry and Hillbilly Terry, otherwise known formally as Terry Compton.
That's right.
And he does have a last name. And we're here tonight live in the studio, but via phone with Mr. Ron Kennedy, who is a best-selling author. And he has a brand new book out with Pelican Publishing entitled Reclaiming Liberty. And Ron, we do appreciate you being on the program with us tonight.
Thank you.
Now, I have to say this. I know Donnie Kennedy is out there somewhere listening to the broadcast right now live. I have no doubt about that. And one of the things he's going to say to me, Ron, is why in the world has Ray not gotten that smoke detector to stop beeping in the background there? I know that that's going to come up the next time you or I, either one, talk to Donnie. And so, Donnie, let me just go ahead and tell you, I actually have a new battery for this smoke detector. However, because of the same neck injury that I had when you were here several weeks ago, I literally cannot raise my right arm over my head to change the thing. So if you're back down this way anytime soon from Louisiana, then please come by and help me change that out, and you won't have to listen to it on the broadcast anymore. Okay.
If any league members listening to your chairman right now, you may want to get a party together to go there and hoist somebody up with a battery in that alarm.
I can hear it now. How many Southerners does it take to change the battery in a smoke detector? Oh, no. Okay. Well, Ron, we do appreciate you being on the program with us tonight, and the book Reclaiming Liberty really does set forth an outline of an actual plan, not just talk about the fact that we need to restore liberty to America and especially to Dixie, but an actual plan to do that. Now, in your book, you talk about the importance of free people creating a free society, and you outline what you call the four requirements for a free society. Now, if you would, for folks that are not familiar with the book yet, tell our listeners what those four requirements are, just in a nutshell, and then why are these four requirements so important for a free people?
Okay, right, thank you. In the chapter, I have a chapter titled The Dimensions of a Liberty-Based Society, because remember, we're talking about something new, something that our people have never seen, really, since 1861, maybe probably by the latest 1865, something that's never been seen before, that is a true society based on liberty. But in order to have a liberty-based society, well, let me give you a little story first. Several years ago, with the fall of the Soviet Union, I can recall, and I think I even mentioned this in the book somewhere, but I recall an interview of a Soviet citizen. She was very concerned about the change from communism, which she grew up in. She's never known anything other than communism and a total socialist state. And she looked at the camera and asked in a most bewildered look, who will tell us how much bread to bake? Who will tell us how many cars to build? Who will tell us who will be a doctor and who will be a lawyer and who will be the mechanic? What shall we do without someone to tell us? I mean, the poor woman, and they're having trouble in former Eastern communist countries now because they never had any what we call a frame of reference for freedom. They never knew what it was to live in a free market-based society. So to her, it was just totally incomprehensible that, you know, all the books or all the cameras or all the bread that you need for a society would spontaneously show up on the shelves because of something that, of course, Adam Smith called the invisible hand, the workings of the free market. Well, our own people today are sort of like that Soviet lady. They don't understand what it's like to live in a true liberty-based society. They have government, nanny state to look out for them. But the first requirement for a liberty-based society is something that most of us grew up in the South knowing about. That's called civility. You know, knowing when and how to act and comport yourself correctly. It's very important because with the loss of civility, what happens? The mobs go crazy. Criminals go crazy. Criminals run so like the insane people are running the asylum. And so people, the people that are law-abiding have to put bars on their windows. You know, we're behind bars and the criminals are running loose because, wow, we've lost this concept of civility. And I describe it in my book as a requirement for a free society because civility in its truest sense means a loyalty to the community that you live with, from whence you come, from whence you draw your values. And the community is important because it is an extension of the family. The family is important because that is how we, under the tutelage of our religion, raise our children. This is where our society comes from, the family. It comes to, and then to the community. That's why the local community and local self-government, a term that you don't hear too much nowadays, is so important. But you can't have a community if you don't have a sense of civility. The second thing that I point out that you need for a free society is a requirement or an honest willingness of non-interference. That means I don't stick my nose in other people's business. If someone else, you know, wants to live one way, that's fine. We will talk about it on a moral ground one way, but I'm not going to take the police power of the state to force you to, say, come to my religion. So we don't interfere with other people's exercise of their rights, non-interference. He said, well, we don't do that in this country. Oh, we do, too. We use the police power of the state to enforce politically correct ideology, whether it's tree-hugging or whether it's someone's concept of, quote, civil rights. You know, discrimination is all right if it's being used to advance somebody else's civil rights. Well, you can't do that without taking rights away from someone else. So the concept of non-interference has to be a part of a free society. And a third aspect is skepticism of government. Oh, our founding fathers had a wonderful skepticism of government because, as George Washington said, you know, government isn't reason. It isn't eloquence. It's like fire, a very dangerous servant, but a fearful master. And so, you know, we don't look to government as a solution to our social issues. We look to the family. We look to the extended family. We look to the community. And we look to those social organizations that we voluntarily create or that we voluntarily subscribe to, such as the church or the synagogue, that helps us to organize and to take care of the community. We do not look to government. Why? Because government, the only way government can do anything is through force. And we believe in the principle of non-interference, we don't believe in the use of force in order to make somebody do what we want them to. And we may work real hard to convince them, to convert them, but on a voluntary basis. So the skepticism of government power, and as you can see from our politicians, they like government power because they can get more and more of our money and therefore limit our freedom. And the last aspect of a our dimension of a liberty-based society is the capacity of a people, a free people, to recognize the immoral the immoral nature of socialism. Now, in welfare, that's socialism. Whether it's social welfare or whether it's corporate welfare, it's socialism. It's the use of government to forcefully extort money from honest, God-fearing, working men and women and use that money for a political purpose. It may be to gain more contributions at the next election, so I'm going to give this big, large corporation a special cut on his taxes. Or it may be that I can gain a block vote by giving this certain segment in the ghetto more welfare. Either case, social welfare or corporate welfare, is the government use of our money to be used against us, and it is, in fact, socialism. So those are what I call the dimensions of a free society, of a liberty-based society. In order to have, if you don't have that, you'll never be able to live free. You'll always go back to saying, but let the government do it for me. Well, the government can't do anything until first it takes our property away from us, the property we have honestly earned. Take it away from us and give it to someone else. That someone else will be someone that will help the politicians stay in power, maintain the status quo, maintain their incumbency.
All right, now, folks, we're talking to Ron Kennedy, and you can get any of their books, including the one we're talking about tonight, Reclaiming Liberty, after you learn more about them and also get around to purchase them through their website, KennedyTwins.com. That's Kennedy Twins. For some reason, my tongue doesn't work. I've had too much chocolate. KennedyTwins.com. And, Ron, I just wanted to make one comment before I ask you the next question. On point two that you brought up about not telling people, minding your own business and not forcing people to do what you want them to do with the power of the state, I find that interesting in view of the fact that some of the biggest opponents of the Southern Freedom Movement today. Hello, Morris. How's Mama and them? Have this myth going around that we're a bunch of Taliban-style theocrats that would force our religion down their throats. So in view of what you just said about it, I think that pretty much blows that myth out of the water.
Oh, absolutely. You know, I hope and I pray that all people accept the Lord and find their way to heaven. But, you know, that's not done through the point of a bayonet. And if I'm not good enough through my personal example and the way I live my life to convince them that this is the way you should live your life, then that's between them and God. You know, that's not for me to try to force someone. And truly, forced conversion, what does that really mean? You know,
but yeah, exactly. Forced by the bayonet into the water to get baptized.
Now, Ron, no, sprinkled, not immersed. See, we start a whole war over that, you know?
Oh, no.
Oh, my goodness. Now, Ron, let's get to the real controversy.
I thought that was the real controversy.
You make a controversial recommendation in your book that a liberty-based society must accept the constitutional principle of secession. Now, I could just hear the neocons lamenting, but how will we hold the country together if we allow a secession? Ron, how do you answer them on that point?
Well, I tell them, you're not. You know, if your country is so bad that nobody wants to stay in there, why should you use the moral suasion of a bloody bayonet to keep them there? Or if you do that, what differs you then from Stalin or Hitler, Mao Zedong? You know, tyranny is tyranny. But, you know, we make this point in the South was right. We made it in was Jefferson Davis right. We made it in Why Not Freedom. I make it in Reclaiming Liberty that our original constitutionally limited Republic of Republics, the wonderful government that was handed down to us by our founding fathers, the right to walk away was given. It was a given. Everyone understood that it was a given. And I'm not going to get into big, lengthy arguments about the whether or not it's there in the Constitution or not. It's not supposed to be in the Constitution. The fact that it's not denied to the states tells me that it was left to the states. So, you know, anybody that wants to get into that argument can go back and look at one of our books. But the point is, if you're the best way to prevent secession or an attempt for secession is to acknowledge the right of secession. Secession is the most peacekeeping, the best way to prevent violence, to prevent antagonism between diverse peoples, is to say we must work together for mutual support of each other, and we must do things that everybody can agree to, or else we're going to lose part of our community. And it's better for us to stay together in a community and have a good trading relationship with each other than it is to have part of our community leave. So let's compromise. Let's work together. Let's not be bellicose. Let's not, you know, threaten our neighbors down south with the bloody bayonet if we don't live up to their way of taxation. We don't want to give all our money to them through high tariffs or through a high income tax. Once you recognize the right of secession, it removes the idea of tyranny and the idea that I have a right to force my will upon a people. It's very simple. If we're all in a room having a party and then somebody starts telling some jokes that we don't like, well, I don't go in for that kind of jokes, you know, and y'all don't do that. Well, we got more of us than it is of you. Well, good, I'm leaving. Okay, you leave. You secede from that unpleasant environment. Now, if the people really wanted you in the party, they would comport themselves accordingly. If they don't, then you leave. But what would happen if they were to slam the door and put an armed guard at the door and say, you're not leaving? That's kidnapping. That's a violation of liberty, which is what happened to the South. And we are in a liberty-based society. We look at the whole country and say, any state, any sovereign community, as John C. Calhoun referred to the sovereign state, that feels that their rights are better protected out of the Union than in the Union, then they have the right to leave.